becoming religious functions a little bit more like falling in love, where you encounter something, an idea of God, a theology, a community, and you can't always really articulate why it is that you're drawn to it, what it is that it's giving you. And so it functions in that way, where we like to try to put it in this academic lens, and it's useful to do that sometimes, but then there's this other way in which it operates where it's totally above that, and you just can't do that.
Kelsey Osgood is a graduate of Columbia University and Goucher College's Creative Nonfiction MFA program. Her work has appeared in New York, The New Yorker, Time, Harper's Magazine, and elsewhere. Her first book, How to Disappear Completely on Modern Anorexia, was chosen for the Barnes & Noble Discover program. I met Kelsey a few years ago when I read a beautiful essay she'd written on how religion helps us come to terms with life's biggest questions concerning life and death. I'm talking with Kelsey today about her new book titled Godstruck and subtitled Seven Women's Unexpected Journeys to Religious Conversion. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. So Kelsey, looking over past episodes of this podcast to see where it was, when it was, you were on the first time. And it turns out it was season one, episode 21, way back in 2021. We're now in season five of the podcast. This will be episode 104. So it's been a little while, and it's great to see you.
It's great to see you too. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a delight. So we're talking today about a book you wrote that is recently in print from Viking. It's a book titled Godstruck, subtitled Seven Women's Unexpected Journeys to Religious Conversion. It's a beautiful book that I know was years in the making, and it's great to see it in print. First of all, before anything else, hearty congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks.
So can you tell us about the origins of the book?
Sure. So I write about this a little in the introduction. I completed a conversion to Orthodox Judaism. Well, an Orthodox conversion, I should say, in 2015. That process usually takes at least a year. For me, it took a little bit more. This was not the beginning of the conversation of the secularization of America and the West more broadly, but it was certainly, that was the predominant feeling at the time, that that we were a secularizing nation and that was basically a good thing. And my conversion process surprised a lot of people in my orbit, not least of them me, or would have surprised past me, I would say. And I think like a lot of the work I do, so my interest grew from my own personal experience and wondering if some of the questions that I asked myself and some of the topics that I mulled over in my religious life were ones that other people who had gone through similar transformations also asked themselves. So naturally, I decided to explore this and something that was very long and gave me a lot of time and space to think about it.
Okay, great. I've got to say, I love the title Godstruck because it captures a motif across all the stories you tell in the book. And that motif is that, you know, the people you discuss, including yourself, all converted less because they were looking for something that fit their lives than because they felt deeply touched and even smitten or struck, right, by something divine. In other words, these aren't individuals who are fitting religion into their lives as much as they're individuals fitting their lives to religion, or so it seemed to me. Does that seem right, what I'm saying to you?
It does, and I think that one of the things I thought about a lot since, and it comes up a little bit in the book, is the way in which, you know, there's a lot of writing these days about what you might call like the sociological facts of being religious or becoming religious. What are the things that having these infrastructures allow people to do? I think a lot of the time, though, like for individual people, becoming religious functions a little bit more like falling in love, where you encounter something, an idea of God, a theology, a community, and you can't always really articulate why it is that you're drawn to it, what it is that it's giving you. And so it functions in that way, where we like to try to put it in this academic lens, and it's useful to do that sometimes, but then there's this other way in which it operates where it's totally above that, and you just can't do that, you know.
I love the falling in love analogy, by the way. Yeah, the question, do your parents like it? Okay, it's brought it home to the parents. Yeah, so the book tells seven conversion stories, right? And one of them is yours. In fact, you weave your own conversion story through all the chapters, which is something I love about the book. It's a way of reflecting on your own conversion by way of others' experiences. But you're also, very attentive to the stories of the six other women who convert to six other religions. This is not just a book about you only at all. To give our listeners a brief overview, perhaps like 30 seconds for each, let's talk about these other six individuals. In fact, I'll read your chapter titles, which are wonderfully descriptive here, and you tell me a little bit about these people here. So chapter one, Angela to the Inner Light of Quakerism.
So Angela is actually a longtime friend of mine. She's a very accomplished writer. She writes about a lot of topics, but I would say her primary bread and butter over the years has been tech and science. And she's a very morally engaged and searching person who was looking for a lot of things. But I would say one of the primary questions for her was, how do I look at humanity and look at human beings and find a way to make them all seem equally valuable?
Great. Chapter two, Sarah, to the ecstatic healing of evangelicalism.
So Sarah is a person who, as a young woman, had a traumatic experience from being very close to the finish line at the Boston Marathon when the bombings happened. And that experience affected her negatively for a number of years after that. And she searched for a way to sort of, I would say, honor the part of her that felt broken as a result of that, and also then heal that part of her. And she found that in this particular understanding of Jesus and what Jesus did for her life.
Okay. Chapter three, Kate to the overpowering revelation of Mormonism.
Right. So Kate, as a young woman, as a teenager, fell into a group of friends who were members of the LDS church in her hometown, and had a young romance with a boy who was about to go on a mission. And then had a, what you might call like an epiphanic, like revelation while she was praying. And even though that early relationship ended, found herself being drawn further into the LDS church, and is now, ended up converting and became a full-fledged member, and
Okay. Chapter four, is it Hannah or Hannah?
Hannah.
Okay, Hannah. So Hannah to the collective embrace of Islam.
So Hannah's from the Midwest originally, and grew up in a family that had, you might call, a lot of dysfunction. Her mom died when she was quite young. Her dad was not around. She was like largely raised by herself and other family members. Discovered Islam in college and actually moved to Saudi Arabia as a young single woman, not that long after she graduated from college. And so her story has a lot to do with what it means to fall in love with a religion, but also how you experience that being an outsider coming into a culture that is very different from the one you were raised in.
Okay, great. Chapter five. And by the way, I've got a compliment. You're doing a really great job telling these stories in little bits.
Thanks.
I could not do that nearly as well. So I'm applauding you as I listen to these descriptions. Chapter five, Christina to the pastoral restraint of the Amish.
Right, so Christina was born in California and then moved to rural Maryland where there's a small Amish community. When she was young, I believe she was eight, and became interested in the Amish. Initially, the way that a lot of people become interested in the Amish is, though, there are these people who look very different. Who are they? Why do they look that way? She felt compelled to do her own research into them, and it just so happens that this small community tends to be, I wouldn't say that the Amish broadly are unwelcoming to outsiders. That wouldn't be a fair characterization, but this one happens to be a little bit more porous, joined the church there. right straight out of high school. And her story is very interesting because it illuminates, I think, a lot of the things that people find very interesting about the Amish, but a lot of the ways in which our sort of preconceptions of the way that they navigate modernity can be slightly off.
Okay, good. Chapter six. I know this name again. Is it Oriane?
Yeah,
Oriane?
Oriane.
Okay, Oriane. So, chapter six, Oriane to the expansive silence of Catholicism.
So Oriane is Canadian. She grew up in an interfaith household. Her mom is Druze by birth, but effectively left the Druze religion when she married Oriane's father, who is comes from a mixed Protestant liberal Mennonite background, but was mostly Protestant growing up when she was growing up. The family sort of loosely affiliated with the Catholic Church. She went to Catholic school. Oriane, I would say, of probably of everybody had a had one of the most natural spiritualities. She just the way she describes her relationship to God and her understanding of God as a child was very easy for her. It doesn't she didn't have lots of big questioning periods of time. But because she wasn't technically Catholic, did have to sort of acclimate to Catholicism over her early life and into college, and then eventually joined an order of sisters, and is now a member of this community and has been for a number of years.
Okay. And then chapter seven, Kelsey to the divine femininity of Judaism.
Right, so that's me. Yeah, so I grew up in a more or less secular or suburb of New York City. Secular meaning when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, everybody kind of celebrated Christmas and Easter, but religion wasn't a dominant force in anybody's life, at least not in the way that I could tell, not in the way that we think of my community now, where it's very obvious that people are religious based on what they wear, what they eat, things like this. We might have spoken about some of this the first time I was on. I was always a very existentially inclined person and child. Questions about why we were here, what life means, how do we understand morality? These were things that felt very pressing to me. I had a lot of, I think a lot of those existential questions were what made me experience a lot of despair in my teenage years and my early adulthood. Ironically, it was through some of that despair that I first encountered Judaism in a way, because a lot of the early observant Jews that I met were in medical settings. And then in my 20s, I don't want to get too in the weeds here, but in my 20s, I'm from New York City. I lived in New York City, so I had a lot of access to very religious Jewish communities where I kind of lurked on the periphery in a really awkward way for a number of years, including writing about them, meeting my now husband, who is not raised observant, but is Jewish by birth. And eventually, realized that something that I for many years had thought of as an anthropological interest, an academic interest, was really something that was very personal and emotional, and was about how I wanted to live my life, how I wanted to raise my children, how I wanted to connect with God. And now, fast forward, and here I am, and it's been 10 years, and I'm about to start cleaning for Pesach. And even though I have a big inferiority complex, I think I'm to a lot of people in my life, I am the craziest religious person they know, even though, yeah, doesn't always feel that way.
Right. Well, I've got to say, the chapter titles again, I love the way you describe these religions. I mean, just these phrases, inner light, ecstatic healing, overpowering revelation, collective embrace, pastoral restraint, expansive silence, divine femininity. It's a book that's very generous toward other faiths, which I really appreciate. And I mentioned earlier that you weave your own story through the various chapters of the book. I'm wondering whether you found your own story at all hard to tell, or instead, by writing about religion and others' conversions, did you find the story almost burst out of you?
It's a good question. So in some ways, I think that actually like writing my own story is the easier task of than compared to writing stories of that other people's stories and writing the more, what you might lump under the heading of like cultural criticism or theology or history and that other third part of the book. So the writing, like, there's no way to say this that isn't super corny, but like when I'm writing, when I'm in the process of writing, I'm really just thinking about like the page and being honest and being open and what's making writing that's compelling. And I think that if you're writing about your own life, it's going to be more compelling if it's honest. And I think to the extent that I worry about, oh gosh, like what is it going to be like when people want to talk to me about my personal life? I'm like, well, that's future Kelsey's problem. You know, like she doesn't, it's not something that I'm thinking about in the moment, for better or worse, right? I think that it becomes a little difficult sometimes, like now at the moment of publication or after publication, where sometimes I guess it can be hard for people to realize that I don't always want to like talk about these things in my in regular social interactions. And I totally get why that is. But the actual writing component of it is not that hard. In a way, it's nice. It can sometimes it can feel cathartic. It feels like it's unburdened from concerns about people are going to tell me that I'm wrong, I made a mistake, or you know, nobody can be like, that's not what happened, because like I'm the only one there, right? So in that way, it's easier, but it can be harder later on.
Okay. Now, so you kindly sent me an advanced copy of the book. It's out. We're recording at a moment when the book is out, like in a day or so. And when this
Tomorrow,
podcast
yeah.
comes, yeah, when the podcast comes out, it'll have been out for a couple of weeks. But I've
Right.
got to say, I took way too many notes reading the book. Okay, and I've got far too many passages I want to discuss with you from the book. And there's no way we're going to get to all of them. But I want to get to at least a few. And I should mention in advance that a lot of these passages focus on your really great descriptions of religious experience, which are what connect all these different stories that you tell in the book. And these are, for me personally, the book's greatest draw. And I'll start with one that you write in the introduction. I'm quoting you here. You write, "If this book is anything, it's a nudge to reconsider organized religion." Okay, why is that, especially since so much attention in recent years has gone toward the SBNR movement, or spiritual but not religious?
Right. So earlier we had mentioned that there are two sort of ways of thinking about religious conversion. One of them is the sort of romantic paradigm, if you will, and the other one is the sort of sociological. I think this question is better answered through the second one, which is the sociological. Why I think that organized religion maybe is worth a reevaluation, if you will, is that a lot of the things that people, a lot of the time these days, there's a people are bemoaning the loss of what you might broadly call community or access to supportive frameworks that nurture their spiritual lives and that also help them in their practical lives, right? I think there's been the sense that for many years that we can do away with organized religion and we can keep the spiritual part, and then we'll figure out the practical part, right? And I mean, I don't want to be too harsh here, but like it hasn't happened. And
No.
I don't see it happening.
No.
And I'm not trying to say that organized religion has never made mistakes, works for every single person, but I am saying that when we're talking about what we want those frameworks, and we haven't. The reason that those frameworks work is because we have this big overarching driving force, which is God, and the things flow from that. I think if you think about the spiritual but not religious movement, the things are flowing from the self. And in some ways, I can see why that would be appealing. And in other ways, I feel that there's no way to get from there. Two, I also want these communities that are going to cradle people from their birth all the way through and that are going to see them really at every stage of their life and nurture them in the best set. I mean, at their best, that's what they do. Just to take 10 seconds, I think the other part of this here is it's interesting to think of the spiritual but not religious idea as being a kind of outgrowth of this American individualism model, right? Which we've seen being taken to task a lot in recent years, as it should be. I think there's this sense that, oh, we've leaned too hard into that. And now we don't have these networks. Our social fabric is fraying. So the spiritual but not religious, it's, you know, it usually doesn't get lumped together with this other part, but I think it makes sense that these things are compatible. And I think that what organized religion teaches you, that's being spiritual but not, cannot teach you by its very definition, is to put the self aside, put this individual needs aside when necessary. Can't do that all the time, of course, but sometimes it is valuable to do that.
No, I think that's completely right. Just speaking of my own experience here, as a person who belongs to an organized religion, right? Mm-hmm. I'm always struck by, increasingly so, kind of the miraculous way that organized religion brings together people in the community who otherwise would never be brought together. I know some of my very closest associates in my faith community are people who feel very differently than I do about political things and social things. And you ask yourself, how in the world would that ever happen in today's tribal America if not for mm-hmm. organized religion? I don't see how. Because it wouldn't be a function of neighborhood, and it wouldn't be a function of, you know, sort of enthusiasm for sports franchises. It really, organized religion really is the thing that kind of brings together communities. And I, increasingly, I'm struck by how unusual and how needed that is. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. So, in the first chapter on your friend Angela Dorn of the Quakers, you devote some attention to the emptiness of rationalism. This is a motif that recurs in your book, but I especially love how you address it here. And I'm going to quote you here. You write, "What if your attempts to arrive at the truth in a systematic way proved dispiriting or untenable, or sometimes simply boring? What if you can't neatly discard the unknowable, like the prospect of a supernatural reality, or the seemingly trivial, like the concept of art for art's sake? What if your rationality brings you somewhere totally inexplicable and, by your own previous standards, ludicrous, an embrace of the seemingly irrational?" Okay, right. So much of the book, it seems, describes how this seemingly irrational attachment to religion actually reveals itself upon close inspection over time to be profoundly rational, right? This is kind of the surprising discovery. You talk about uncovering, for example, some of the deep wisdom of the Sabbath, or styles of religious dress or ritual and so on. Here's my question then, how do you in your own religious life negotiate that relationship between the rational and the irrational, or put it differently, between the outwardly rational and the kind of rationality that only reveals itself through religious practice?
Okay, I think that there might be a muscle memory aspect to it, that once you become accustomed to sort of moving back and forth in your life between approaching your ritual life or your religious life more broadly from a rational perspective or an irrational one, for lack of a better way to put it, it becomes easier to do that. For me personally, I don't like to be too much in one lane all the time. I like to be able to move back and forth between them. And I think Judaism is a very flexible belief system. I mean, there are a lot of people who like to say things to the extent like, oh, it's okay to be Jewish and an atheist. I think those things tend to be overblown. But I do think, like, as a theology, it is, you know, it is very forgiving in terms of like how you get there, how you land where you need to land. There are lots of ways in there. It's also interesting to me, I have young children. My eldest is almost 8. And it's interesting to me to have to verbalize some of these things to him when he has his own questions. And, you know, he comes home from school. And the other day he said to me something like, we were repeating a story, and he said, "That sounds like a midrash." We don't know what a midrash is. It's these these kind of beautiful, almost like fanciful stories of biblical exegesis that been collected over centuries. They're not part of the Torah. They're held holy. And my son said, "Well, they're not real, right?" And so it was interesting to me to have to answer him in this way, where I said to him, I actually feel that I can believe that they're literally true and also poetically true and true in all of these ways. And I can go back and forth between them and also hold these things together for myself in a way that I feel like I can do that. It's not hard for me, actually. So that's been interesting,
Yeah,
an
you
interesting
bet.
way of thinking about this.
Okay, on that subject, holding together what seems like real, like materially real, and also poetically true. Let me ask you, in the chapter about Sarah, who converts to evangelicalism, you describe attending a worship service with her where the minister discusses the story of the woman in the New Testament who reaches out and touches Jesus's clothing, right? In the hopes of being, expectation of being healed. And you then share that you, and I'm quoting you here, you had recently been devastated by the news that you had a condition that would make it very difficult and dangerous for you to bear a third child. Close quote. You reflect on the emotional pain and the spiritual pain that this brought to you, and how you found yourself in the position of that woman in the story, seeking a cure from God. And you remark that the only thing we can ask of pain is that it just not be absurd, right? And that in this your time of crisis, you felt your soul deepening, as though you were communing with God in that pain. And you say you didn't feel like you were being miraculously healed by that experience when you were attending that meeting with Sarah, or that, and she was in the moment seeking her own healing from a kind of an ailment she had also. But, and she must have known, you say it was unlikely she'd find healing. But you write, and this is very moving, quote here, I couldn't dismiss her impulse to seek healing as ridiculous in the way I assumed most would. I didn't think that she'd be healed that day, that's true, but I didn't think praying for it, believing it was possible, was nonsensical either. Okay, this is great, right? And here's, I guess, we get to my question this way. So much of that, I think, goes to the heart of religious life, right? Believing that God can heal us and presenting ourselves before God, not necessarily finding the healing that we were seeking, but finding something like it, something powerful and mind and soul opening nonetheless. Can you comment either on that experience or on this phenomenon itself you're trying to capture in that story, where, again, not believing that you would be healed necessarily, but not believing that you couldn't be either, and finding something else altogether?
I mean, I think it's something that a lot, if not all, religious people struggle with. It goes to the heart of this question of if we believe in a God that can do anything, why can't he solve this problem? Or, and I think this question comes up a lot when, particularly when we're dealing with something that's physically, illness or infertility. Or potential at the end of life, I suppose. And I always worry that maybe it feels from the outside like a cop out to say, okay, well, even though I didn't get what I want, it's actually in the end I did get what I want, but that's a total other story. Even though I wasn't being healed in this miraculous way that we would have expected people in ancient times, so people in the Bible to be healed, still I got all these other things, and it's still good enough. I mean, I guess I don't. I think my answer to it is just that we move through pain, regardless of whether or not we're religious or secular. We have to move through pain if we want to survive, and we have to figure out a way to make meaning and sense out of that. And for me, feeling like there was a logic to what I was going through, and also this sense that I could do it. I could get to the place that I needed to be, even if I wasn't going to get what I wanted in the end. I trusted that God would give me what I needed to do to survive through that. It was all that I it was what I needed to get through. And I think that because, like Sarah, I really felt that I had experiences where I went to the predictable places one goes to when one is in pain, psychic pain or physical pain. And I knew that those places couldn't always give you the kind of certainty that we modern people expect either. And so to me, there was something when I go back to when I go to my faith and when I go to God with that, even though there's more uncertainty there, even the more uncertainty feels more honest in a way, that there's an acknowledgement of kind of this is just challenging, but we're not in control. That felt better to me than in some ways than going to, for example, in this particular case, than going to doctors and sort of being given every once in a while the kind of promise of control or the illusion of control. which ultimately really wasn't there, you know?
I think that's really profound. I love that, the idea of having to acknowledge the lack of control. That mm-hmm. seems very true to our mortal, even existential experience. I also find, you know, looking forward, it makes sense to me looking forward, you know, sort of to God in hope for what we want, even if it doesn't mean we get what we want in the moment. And then when I finally look back, I'm often amazed at the things that have happened in life that have seemed sort of touched by sort of the divine hand in some way, you know, that I said to myself at the time, I'm not getting what I need here. And I actually look back in hindsight, no, actually I did, but I wouldn't have been open to it or perceived it without that perspective. So I love that. And I've got to ask you about your experience with therapy.
Mm-hmm.
In part because my wife is a therapist. Okay. So yeah, here we go. So ultimately, I'm quoting you again. So ultimately, religion offered me, you say, three things that therapy did not. The first is an off-ramp from introspection. Second, religion also gave me a healthy skepticism of the power of the intellect. And third, religion gave me a model of redemption and resilience far beyond what the biomedical view did. Okay, and you summarize these religious affordances this way, quoting you again, when I started to open myself to the idea of God, I found a new, unending source of power and joy. Now, this all resonates with me, and I think it with my wife, too, right, the therapist. And your point, as I take it, isn't that therapy is bad, only that it really it's no substitute for religion. And in your experience, is there anything like a therapeutic equivalent for the feelings of redemption and joy you found in God? Is what you found in religion a difference of degree? Like you found more of it in God than you would in therapy? Or is it an all-out difference in kind?
Good question, because when we talk about therapy, when we say the word therapy, we can mean a lot of different things, right? So probably useful to point out that like my major, the major therapized part of my life, if you will, it stems from sort of the late 90s to, I guess, just right before 2010, maybe. And this was a period of time where, at least in the kind of treatment that I was in, it was I read something that described it this way just this morning, actually, coincidentally. It was kind of the zenith of the biomedical model, right? So so the push was to, and this was this came up more when we were talking about, like, you know, psychiatry, but also in regular sort of therapeutic encounters generally too. The push, in my experience, was really to kind of get down to the root of one's problem and then codify that problem, say what that problem was, and reduce it to a medical understanding. Now, I think that the core of the therapeutic experience, which is being able to be open and honest with another person who you feel is smart, well, I mean, hopefully that's important to you, but who you feel is like smart and is listening to you in a patient and kind way, is invaluable. I think that sometimes certainly where I feel that therapy became counterproductive in my own life, and I think you see echoes of this culturally generally, is then the impulse to make certain and knowable the core of the self in a way that I'm just not sure is necessarily healthy for people or is even possible, right? And I want to say here that I actually think that religion also over in certain iterations can fall into similar traps where we think that, you know, if we just do enough work in this regard, we can make ourselves perfect. We can make the human being a machine that will never make mistakes. I think for me, at the end of my therapeutic life, it just became hard for me to square also certain aspects of my existential questions, I think were really taken as evidence of pathology, frankly, when I was in my early to, it was probably 20 to 25, I had a lot of questions about the value of suffering. Is there any value? And I feel that the answers that I was given were not only like relatively pat, but also were like, well, the fact that you would ask these questions in the first place indicate that you're your soul, you're still troubled. Like it's evidence of the fact that you're troubled. Whereas I wish, and I think that there are probably therapists in the world who do this, who I wish somebody had said, these are the kinds of questions that like philosophers have been asking for centuries, and it makes sense that you would ask them because they're big questions and nobody knows. And I don't know either. There was a lot of, I felt really once they nailed down, this is who you are and this is what you're dealing with, where it felt like a kind of rigidity that wasn't, that I felt that to really ascribe to that view of myself would have been limiting in the long term. I wasn't a person who wanted to identify, and I think there are people who want this, and I think there are people who maybe need to, but I wasn't a person who wanted to identify with diagnoses forever. I felt very confident that if we were going to move through this process, then I was going to move beyond that.
Yeah, no good. I've got to say that I find it so striking, the thought that someone would sort of receive someone's large questions as a sign of bad mental health. When actually it's a sign of like good spiritual health, like seeking some kind of larger reason for our existence. That to me, it's a sign of an open mind.
Yeah, I think I have to have some sympathy for these people. It wasn't like I just plopped in there and it was day one that they did this. These were people who had known me for a while. So maybe they were used to thinking about things in the context of my struggling. But I remember there's this one really funny anecdote, and I won't spend too long on it. I had an individual therapist, and I went also into a group therapy, and these people communicated with one another. And I remember in the group therapy, I was talking about having seen maybe it was the Bergman film Silence or some Bergman. And then my regular therapist told me that the group therapist called her and said, "You got to be careful. She's watching a lot of Bergman, And so it was like, I understand that they felt like, oh, these are like, some of these things, some of these preoccupations of mine, whatever, it looks like depression. I get that. But it's also like, okay, it's Bergman, you can't. How can you fault a college kid for being interested in Bergman and existentialism? It's just part of the process, I think.
That's right. Okay. On Bergman, I've got to say, I read a passage last week to my class in your book because I was just so, I loved it so much.
Oh,
One of
thanks.
your descriptions of religious experience. It's a passage. I'll read this as an aside almost, but it's a book, a passionate book that comments on two very different kinds of divine silence. Right, it begins with a time as a child when you decided God did not or could not exist, and I'm quoting you here: "What followed was 13 years of silence, like the kind experienced by character in Bergman films and Chisako Endo novels. Silence inside and silence beyond. Silence that felt dense and depressing, but also angry and bitter and tense, like spiritual tinnitus. Sensory deprivation chamber silence, rather than its opposite, that of the countryside, of the bottom of a canyon, of the night sky." That's so great, Kelsey. That's
Thank
so
you.
great, right? For the different kind, not all silence is the same silence at all, right? I love how you capture that. And speaking of religious experiences and spiritual experiences, I cannot but bring a little attention to the chapter on Kate, right? Converts to the Mormonism, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is my faith tradition. So forgive this question. I've got to ask this.
Sure.
But I love the description you give in this chapter of spiritual experience. And these are both your words and Kate's. Okay, I'm going to quote the book here. As Kate prayed one night, quote, "A warm blast of heat seemed to burst from her chest, flooding her with joy. Every time she's tasked with describing it, she paints roughly the same image. It was a light in my heart, an explosion of goodness, a bloom of happiness, like the most vibrant sunrise you've ever seen, so bright you can't look directly at it. What made the experience so enthralling was the way that it was entirely unprecedented." She goes on, "It was so unlike anything else I'd felt that I was like, well, this has to be something more. The only way I could explain that was it was God." And then you comment, "In that fraction of a second, Kate's perception of herself shifted from a non-believer, an atheist, she called herself, to a person of faith." All right. Now, the range of spiritual experiences is very wide, and your book captures many different kinds of them. But I teach courses on spiritual experience and literature, and I'm always struck by the vivid metaphors here. in Kate's account, a light in my heart, you know, an explosion of goodness, a bloom of happiness, and so on. In literary texts, metaphor is often cited as an indication of intensifications of our experience. It's a manifestation of our need to express something powerful and unique and new. Metaphor is a trope of conversion. It changes how we see something. So this goes to my question for how you wrote this book and how you captured these experiences yourself, Kelsey, right? In writing the book about religious conversion, did you find yourself reaching for new ways to speak or write? Or, because you are a professional writer, was the process of writing about this subject the same, but only the subject matter itself being different? See my question? It's like, in writing about religion, did you find you had to write differently, or was it the same writing, just different subject matter?
I would say that it was, I'm not sure that the writing itself was different, or that my sort of where I came at things, or when I feel like when, if you're a writer, there's always a special joy in sort of knowing that you've landed on a really good metaphor or simile. I feel that myself. I feel that where metaphors sometimes came in handy, and I can think of one example in particular, was sometimes in describing religious experiences that are maybe outside of my own faith tradition, or ones that I just don't have personal experience with. And the best example I can think of this is actually related to LDS belief, which actually was a paragraph that I think I cut out, but it was enormously helpful to me when I was trying to really parse a personal revelation, what it is and what it isn't. And you're going to be able to fill in the name for me here, and you'll forgive me for having forgotten this, but there was a paragraph that I had in there originally that somebody had given a speech, I think it might have been a general conference, that described various ways of thinking about personal revelation, for example, a sunrise, so a very slow realization that something is happening.
This is Elder David A. Bednar, it's who this is.
Yes, and actually I think that Kate is the one who originally recommended this to me when we were talking about this topic, versus, you know, going into a room and turning on a light switch. So I had I had to take it out just for a word count, but I had that, I basically summarized that speech in the text itself, because that framework, that metaphorical framework, helped me to understand something that prior to that I had felt that I wasn't grasping in a way. And so thank you, Elder, for that.
Yeah. No, it's a good talk he gave. It's about three different forms of revelation. There are many more than three, but he gave three schematic examples. Sometimes a light just turns on. It was dark, and suddenly it's light. Other times, you see a sunrise forming, and it's getting lighter, brighter, brighter. Suddenly, boom! It bursts on you with its full glory. Other times, it's like a foggy morning, dense fog, clouds, and you don't really notice the sun coming up at all. But you notice at some point that it's light enough to kind of make your way through the day, and you go about. It's gray but light. As three different kinds of revelation. It's a very good way to describe different kinds of spiritual experience. I love the observation you and the story, and also invitation you share in this chapter. I'm going to quote you again. This is in the same chapter. When you think it's possible that God is communicating to you in the text of your everyday life, you tend to pay closer attention. You peer at the things around you to perceive the intrinsic meaning shining out from within them, blades of grass, rocks, rabbits, other people. One recent winter day, a light snow fell early in the morning, but only a few hours later it looked like the snow had ended until I strained to see across the street to a neighbor's house, and in changing my perspective, saw the flakes again, so tiny they were floating upward with the breeze. "Is that you, capital Y-O-U?" I asked. No one answered, but I felt a subtle warmth. It's a wonderful challenge, trying to see God everywhere. You should try it sometime. That's lovely. Yeah. It's the book, I've got to commend this to the listeners. It's just a beautiful book in the way that it writes about religion and religious experience across all these different traditions. That's a real gift, Kelsey, of yours in the book, which I really appreciate. Thank you. So on the chapter about Hannah, the convert to Islam, you talk about the challenge of converting to a religion associated with an ethnic minority when you yourself were not born into that minority. And I'll read a passage concluding and ask you to answer the question that the passage itself poses, okay? So a quote from the book, "One can imagine why a member of a minority would want to take on something that brings them closer, at least in theory, to the majority whenever or wherever it is they live. But what about when someone takes on the identity, the beliefs, the characteristics, the vernacular, the dress of a minority, as Hannah and I did? And what if that minority culture is one that has been historically persecuted, but you can't claim that distinction with your birth identity? At a time when people are sensitive, occasionally hypersensitive, to the idea of adopting a new cultural persona, what are we to make of religious converts who inevitably do just that?" Okay, good question. Question to you. How do you answer that question?
It's very challenging. I think there isn't one hard and fast rule. Well, I will say that I think one clear answer is that if you're talking about, for example, let's use Hannah and I as examples, we're both joining faiths that where you could really apply all of those descriptors that you just used to both of our faiths in certain contexts. I mean, both of these faiths welcome converts. You know, Judaism is a non-proselytizing religion, but there are pathways to conversion. They don't, you know, they're not closed to converts. And so I think you have to take the community at face value when they say that they want that. And, you know, I think that I personally feel some degree of self-consciousness about, I should give it a caveat here, which is that it's just like part of my nature to do a lot of thinking about like the self. What is the self? Like how much of the self is performance and how much is authentic? This is like really fun, I'm sure, for everybody in my personal life. But, you know, so these things might come to mind. I think they do probably come to mind a lot more for me than they do for most of the converts that I know. I'm not saying they never do for those people, but I think for me, they come to mind a lot more. But I think that I was very sensitive to the fact that I didn't want to be overstepping in terms of overly identifying with, let's say, a historical aspect that I didn't feel was right for me to necessarily own. And I think that's and I also didn't want to look to, I had some discomfort with the idea that becoming religious was going to make me an entirely new person. You know, I mean, in some ways in Judaism anyway, there's theological support for that. And in most faiths there are where it is promised, okay, you're going to be new. You're going to be totally new. And I don't know I already said it, so it doesn't matter if it's heretical or not, but like, I was sort of like, I don't know, man, I think I'm going to carry some of these problems into my new life. And a lot of life is just mundane stuff that you're going about your day, and you're the product of the socialization of your childhood and your early life, and you can't get rid of that entirely. And maybe God doesn't want you to get rid of that. Maybe you bring something with you to the table that's valuable in that respect. I mean, I think in some ways I don't have all the answers to these questions, and in some ways I think some of the answers have to do with just cultural appropriation generally, but then there's this just fascinating twist of, well, what if the people you're culturally appropriating from kind of want to be appropriated? I just liked to explore that. And yeah, it's interesting. This is another one where it's interesting to me as my kids get older. And as I, you know, they know obviously about my background. They know, you know, I have a good relationship with my family. And so they're aware that there's this difference there, but then there's this other part of them that I really hope that they don't have that, they don't have the kind of, you know, vulnerability in terms of their Jewish identity the way that I do. They're at the moment, they have none of it. And I actually do hope that stays the case.
Okay. So, this is a book full of so many great passages. There are a couple more I want to talk about here today on the podcast, and they speak to your own conversion. And I wonder actually here if you would read them, kind of the voice of the writer, and then comment on them. One is from chapter 6, which is the chapter on your friend who converts to Catholicism. This is Oriane. And it's on, this is a pre-publication copy, but page 250.
I'll find it.
Yeah.
It's what, a paragraph.
Page 250. It begins, personally, I don't feel deprived.
Okay, let me see if I can. Yeah. Okay. So let's say, personally, I don't feel deprived of much because of my religious beliefs. Though there are strains of it in Hasidism, Judaism isn't an overly ascetic faith. Mostly, it's a belief system that exalts moderation in most things. I'm still able to live in my own house, acquire possessions, go on vacation, and so on. Because I am, quote-unquote, modern Orthodox, I can partake of a wide range of cultural offerings in the form of literature, film, and art, although I try to do so judiciously. But there are some things I have had to let go of, and though many of these feel puny in comparison to what desert ascetics or contemporary nuns relinquish, I am often surprised to be reminded that others are slightly scandalized by this, until I remember that our secular contemporary culture, which largely venerates the ability to have one's desires met rather than the ability to overcome said desires, has given people almost no framework for understanding sacrifice.
Yeah, can you comment on that? What I found really struck out to me, the reason why I stopped and then paused, is that, you know, the idea that, as toward the back end especially, our secular contemporary culture, which largely venerates the ability to have one's desires met, right, rather than the ability to overcome said desires, has given people almost no framework for understanding sacrifice. I don't know how we're going to make it as a culture, as a species, frankly, without having to learn the lessons of sacrifice at some level. And yet we don't seem to have those lessons given to us very much, certainly by consumer culture. But religion does give those to us. I'd love you to comment on that.
Yeah, I think that particularly, you know, I'm not a historian, but I would say you see this ramping up in the second half of the 20th century, right? The moving away from the idea of those tight networks and of the thing that the individual must give up, or that the individual owes to the tight network, whether that's like you give up, you know, you fight for your country, or you give up as a parent. And I understand, we can understand why these things happened, and also sort of recognize that there were problems in the way that they did happen, right? So in moving away from understanding ourselves as being part of systems that many people maybe experienced as onerous, or nobody explained to them, why am I giving up these things? Or we all know people who are raised with an idea of religion where you were just told, give things up, but you weren't said, nobody told you why you did these things. But then, like in a lot of things in life and in broad cultural movements, there's an overreaction. And now we have to go to, well, now you shouldn't do anything that makes you feel bad. Nothing, you know, everything has to spring from this authentic, now here's this old chestnut again, this authentic self inside. And if you don't, if it's not coming from there, then it must be bad. You don't, you know. And I think that that was like a pretty massive, it was too far in the other direction. A marriage between these two models is probably the best. And I think we might be moving, I think there is, you see shifts a little bit. I think I see it a little bit in the conversation around motherhood. Although, you know, recently, I mean, if the discourse is like a little bit, so it can still be a little like intense and overly simplistic. But I think there was, you know, I write in a different part of the book about feeling very jarred in early motherhood at not really having understood that I was, what kind of autonomy I was going to be given up, I was being asked to give up. And feeling like upset at myself that I wasn't able to handle this gracefully. And I see at the time, and still to this day, a little, the media landscape was really about that, about how horrible it was to be a parent because nobody told you you were going to have to give up all these things. And you see it kind of being renegotiated now, where there are thoughtful voices who are saying, you know, okay, well, let's look at this again. And what... Yes, you're being asked to give something up, but is there no area of life where that wouldn't be valuable? You know, like, is there no context in which you can consider that that would be a healthy thing to do? and that it might actually, in a backward way, be beneficial to you to give things up. So I think we might be in a period of trying to walk some of it back. But I would say, like, for most of my life, really, it was just kind of, girl boss, whatever makes you happy, this kind of, American self-help, how to make friends and influence people hangover thing. And that didn't really teach people my age or my generation what it meant when you came to the limits of that. And you get there pretty fast, I think, even if you're not really like you get there, you'll get there.
Amen. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, I agree. That's great, Kelsey. Thank you. We have time for one last passage. And this is the last paragraph of chapter 7, which is the chapter about your own conversion experience. I think it's a beautiful paragraph. Would you read that for us, then comment on it?
Yes.
And if you don't want to comment, you can just read the paragraph and say mic drop, and we'll call it that.
Okay. So I think we're starting with, so why still go? Okay. So why still go? Why still do any of this at all if I recognize some inherent imbalance there? Why spend days cooking huge meals, dusting the tiniest motes of bread from my cabinets before Pesach, pushing my mind and body, or sorry, my body and mind in pursuit of having children? The responses are myriad. Because I believe in the value of sacrifice, because I believe in the entire enterprise of Judaism. Because I feel strongly that just because I'm going through a difficult time with a particular thing doesn't mean the thing ceases to have worth or should be discarded immediately. Would you divorce your spouse after a single rough patch? Because I believe the benefits outweigh the costs. Because I feel like a whole person now, one who knows how to take care of things, who knows how it feels to have obligations and meet them, who knows how to play a long game, who understands that inextricable interplay between love and pain, between fulfillment and abstinence, between creation and death. And because I believe Judaism taught me all this in a way nothing else ever could. Because I do actually believe that God literally told us to utilize a mikveh, and also that we'll never quite understand why that is, and there is value in just doing it regardless. Because I'm pretty sure I would have wanted all this anyway, a husband, family, a house, and odds look good that had I pursued it outside a supportive framework, I'd have been left very angry and lonely indeed. Because I do want to be like the Eishes Chayil at the end of the day. I want my lamp to never go out at night, and I want to feel cloaked in strength and dignity and to laugh in the face of the future, just like she does. So to give like a slight context, Eishes Chayil is not a singular person, but an idea of entrepreneurial, spiritual womanhood. She's the perfect woman in Judaism. And we sing a song about her on Friday night on Sabbath. And I think for a lot of Jews, I don't think I'm alone in thinking, on the one hand, it's this incredible model of Jewish female success, but it's also very, it's a lot to live up to. And I think a lot of the time, probably most of my peers don't feel that we're doing that. So I think what I'm trying to get to in this particular paragraph is stuff we've touched on in the throughout the conversation, which is in Judaism in particular, there are so many pathways and so many ways to think about the way that we experience our faith and the way that we live it out. We can talk about it through this total submission model where, okay, I don't know why you want me to do this, but I'm going. I'm leading my son up a mountain. I don't know why God is telling me to do it, but I'm doing it. Or I can think about it in this way of, okay, maybe today that feels a little far-fetched for me. I don't know. Like sometimes I have my doubts, but I see the sociological value, or I see the value it gives me in terms of understanding my relationships in the real embodied world. Or I understand it in terms of it's giving me something in my life, it's healing something in my past, or it's taking care of some of my own baggage. And I think that these things are not mutually exclusive. All of these things live within us as people, as religious people and people generally. And I don't necessarily feel like I have to choose, but I feel blessed to have all of these pathways in, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book you've written, Kelsey. I love the book. I love its attention to the diversity of religious experiences. And even more, I love the common thread that links that diversity, which is the experience of a love for and an awe at the wonder and the promise of God. Thank you for writing this book. I wish it great success. And thank you for coming on the podcast to talk with me about it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.